This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omised, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omised.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Hey, sports fans, it's Mason Crosby.
And Reese Crosby.
If you enjoy football, football,
be sure to check out Kicking It with the Crosbys. New episodes drop every Tuesday and Thursday.
Subscribe on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A beautiful orange sunrise on the horizon, but in the foreground, the Crescent City Connection, beautifully lit in purple, gold, and green on this Tuesday, February 25th. As we get ready for Mardi Gras, with parades resuming tonight, but the parades tonight will be just like they were scheduled for on Sunday, but no bands. That's going to be the difference. Just floats. Be aware of that. Right now it's 51 degrees. Some fog around. Be aware of that. Highs of about 67 today, 72 tomorrow, 71 on Thursday, 68 on Friday, 72 on Saturday, 71 on Sunday. Notice I didn't say anything about rain. Then we get to Lundi Gras, and we got a 50% chance for showers then, 50% on Mardi Gras Day itself, highs of 67 Lundi Gras, 75 on Mardi Gras, but as Peyton Malone said, it all depends on the timing, so we'll have to watch it. We were going to talk about debit and credit cards. What's the best way to pay? You can text me at 504-260-1870 and let me know, and I was kidding around about five things that you did last week. And some of the texts that come in, and they say, let me go to the text line here. I work my A off making deliveries for the past 5 days, and I don't make $106,000 a year, and I don't have health insurance or retirement. Now, what that tells me is that you're angry that you're not a federal employee, and you're envious of federal employees. So if that's the case, I would say go get yourself a job as a federal employee. Now, I'm not saying that there's not a lot of waste in federal government. That's not the point at all. But I think sometimes it's disingenuous to hold a government employee to a standard that we don't hold ourselves to, because you expect to exact every ounce of sweat that you can out of a government employee because they're working on a taxpayer's dime. But yet, if you own stock in a company, let's be honest, they're kind of working for you as well at the company, right? So it's the old thing, if you got time to lean, you got time to clean. Remember when you were a kid working at this job? And all I'm saying is, let's keep it honest and keep it real and look ourselves in the mirror and hold ourselves to the same standard that we hold federal employees. Because unless you absolutely did not screw around at work last week or pilfer anything from work or steal time or anything else or take a long lunch, and you're absolutely perfect, well, then you're kind of being disingenuous when it comes to federal employees and saying they're all goofballs and slackers and everything else. Somebody else, and going back, you know, years ago, I was talking about food stamps. The things that get most people angry about food stamps is that they don't get them. And I think that was proved out when we had the hurricane and people stood in line for 8 hours to get their $300 for bad groceries from FEMA. And when I said, well, why are we doing that? And they would said, well, now it's my turn. Even though I don't need it, it's my turn to get my share. Somebody texted in, this is a tongue-in-cheek, did a bunch of ketamine, ignored my 13 kids, waved a chainsaw around on stage, participated in massive contributing to unemployment at agencies regulating my businesses. I've helped tank the stock of those same businesses. Tongue in cheek. Why are Trump and Doge demonizing federal workers? It's really disturbing that American citizens are being treated like an enemy when in reality they are no different than the rest of us. They were hired for a job and they're just trying to survive. It's truly disturbing that these sadists are celebrating people losing their jobs. My problem is that you can't just fire everybody. You can't just eliminate everybody, because when you look at Reagan, who was a Republican and fired all the air traffic controllers, it took us a while to recover from that. And I think there is a lot of waste in federal government, just as I think there are a lot of weeds in lawns and there are a lot of products on the shelves that shouldn't be there and a lot of things on the internet that shouldn't be there. But do you just shut the internet down? No. Do you just kill the entire lawn? Probably not, because it's taken a while to come back. So I think you have to go in with a surgical approach and not a chainsaw. I think you need a scalpel, not a chainsaw. That's my problem. And somebody texted in yesterday about Tommy, let me get to this, too. Tommy, you're smarter than that. If somebody doesn't answer at all, they're not doing anything or not actually there. Well, I would hope whoever texted this in is smarter than that. You want to see if somebody's there. Offer them something free. That'll tell you if they're there or not. Don't tell me, don't say, give me some five things that you did. Say, look, here's the deal. We got free tickets for this concert, or $100 of free food stamps if you reply to this email, and then put something in fine print about it's just a test, and that would tell you who's there and who's not. That would be the way to get people to respond, not send me five things. And the other problem I have is I like golf. I love golf, and golf is set by the rules, right? Everybody follows the rules. Sometimes the rules are to your advantage, sometimes they're not. And I don't know where Elon Musk, I know the president gave him the authority, but I don't like this guy from South Africa, who is not an American citizen, coming in and just derailing federal government. And he's done some shady things in the past with his business practices. He's no saint. And I just don't trust him. And somebody texted in yesterday and said, why do you trust Fifth District? Well, I trust Fifth District because I've been doing business with them for years and years, and I know them. And I know what they're all about. I don't know what Elon Musk is all about. I do know that he's moving towards, and we had a guest tell us this last week, proprietary charging stations for his vehicles. So if you drive a Tesla, you may not want to hear this, or as you look around at Teslas, you could be putting all your money in Elon Musk's charging stations, and you don't have a choice but to get them charged there. Now, some people will disagree with that. I'm just telling you what the expert told us. So I don't trust Elon Musk to handle the federal government. I didn't vote for Elon Musk, and that's where I stand on it. 621 traffic now, WWL. All right, 626, let's talk about the weather. Why don't we? Sean O'Neill joins us now, meteorologist. How you doing, Sean?
Hey, how's it going this morning?
I'm all right. I don't mean to stereotype here or anything, but I would imagine, Sean O'Neill, you're looking forward to St. Patrick's Day?
Absolutely. Actually, my son was born on St. Patrick's Day, so we have a good time every year.
from what part of the island? Do you know your family hails?
No, I'm actually not 100% sure.
Have you ever been?
I have to find that one out. I'd love to go, though.
Dude, yeah. You got to go. It is a beautiful country. I was lucky enough to go, and it really is beautiful. It really is.
Definitely on the bucket list.
All right, let's talk about the weather here for Mardi Gras. What's going to happen? Take us from today on.
Yeah, so today on really looks really good. The only issue we could possibly have is later, as we get closer to Mardi Gras Day, we are expecting another system to come through the area. The timing on that system is a little up in the air right now. Could be Tuesday, could wait till Wednesday. But up until then, it's just going to be absolutely gorgeous. I mean, couldn't be better weather from now until early next week. We're going to be in the 70s pretty much every day. The weekend especially looks amazing. Probably 70, 71 degrees both days. Could have a little bit of fog in the morning, especially, you notice, I'm sure everybody's noticing that this morning. Could be an issue a couple of mornings, but really for parades, obviously not going to be an issue. That'll burn off way before any parades during the week, and the weekend just looks amazing.
So when it comes to this timing on Mardi Gras Day and Lundi Gras, timing of what, and like, is it a front? Are you talking about all day rain, shower here or there? What are we talking about potentially?
Yeah, it's really that there isn't a whole lot of model agreement right now and it would be a front, but there isn't a whole lot of model agreement right now to really kind of pinpoint that. That's at the far end, the 7-day part of the forecast, and those things tend to change pretty frequently. So You know, there's a chance of rain on Tuesday right now, but it could that could definitely change either way at this point.
So when will we know?
Well, of course, as it goes with this stuff, the closer we get to it, the better that stuff comes into agreement. So, in the next day or two, we'll probably get some clarification on that. But, I don't want to say it's definitely going to rain on Tuesday because I do think there's a chance that could change. And so hopefully it'll change for the better for us.
If it would rain on Tuesday, and I'm asking you to predict what you're not sure of right now, are you talking about scattered showers? You're talking about a rainout? What are we talking about?
Yeah, right now it would probably be passing. It would probably be a line passing through. And so obviously the timing on that would be very important, right? If it came through Tuesday night, that wouldn't be as big of a deal as if it came through Tuesday morning. So Those are all things we'll have to see how they develop here in the next day or two.
You're talking about rain like we had Sunday?
No, this would be more like a front, like a squall line kind of coming through and would be more on that rain. It's not looking like an all-day rain right now at this point.
When do you think we'll know?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? Yeah, but, probably in the next day or two, those things will start to come into a little more clarity.
So you can tell me between now and what, Lundy Gras, all good?
Yeah, really good.
Okay.
Really good. I mean, again, the weekend is going to be absolutely amazing. Those parades are going to have a wonderful time. So,
you know what? I'll take it. Sean, I'm gonna go there while the news is good. Thank you, sir, and top of the morning to you.
All right. No problem. You too.
You too. Sean O'Neill, meteorologist. Somebody texting about Elon Musk being a citizen. Elon Musk is not a natural-born American citizen. He was born in Pretoria, South Africa. His mother's Canadian. That allowed him to obtain Canadian citizenship in 1989. He moved to Canada at 17. Then he transferred to the University of Pennsylvania in 1992 on an exchange visitor visa. So because he's not born in the U.S., he's ineligible to run for president, as the Constitution requires natural-born citizenship for presidential candidates. So Elon Musk is, hate to tell you, an immigrant. 6:30, more when we come back, WWL. All right, 6:44, 16 till 7. You heard Sean O'Neill from the National Weather Center. Fine young lad at the National Weather Center telling us that the weather's going to be nice all the way through Lundy Gras, then Mardi Gras, maybe some rain, maybe Lundy Gras night. We'll have to see how that plays out. Danielle Del Sol joins us, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. Good morning, Danielle. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Danielle, everybody has a story. How does one become Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans?
You just stick around long enough. I've been with the PRC for 14 years, and after 7 years, I was named executive director. I fell in love with preservation as a journalist and moved to New Orleans and never looked back.
For you young people listening at home, remember what Danielle said. You just stick around long enough. That's the key. Let's talk about...
I started as an intern.
Seriously, I know. I'm not kidding you. I mean that sincerely. People don't realize that. It's a lot simpler than you think. Show up on time. Do what you're supposed to do. Don't say no. Make yourself available. Do what they tell you to do, and you'd be surprised how quickly you can move up. And I'm not kidding. I mean
that's
sincerely.
Right. Yeah.
Right, let's talk about
agreed.
Buildings in New Orleans. Why are so many collapsing, or are so many collapsing?
Well, I will say I think that it's a coincidence that so many fell down so dramatically this fall and winter. So we need not be alarmed. But we do live in a historic building with an incredible number of historic structures that need maintenance, and they're not being maintained properly. We have a huge number of negligent property owners who are not taking care of their buildings in the city, and the city has not funded its own departments so that they have enough staff and resources to actually take care of that problem and hold negligent property owners to account, with people that out there on the ground daily to cite building owners and, take them through the legal processes. And then we also need to do a better job informing, responsible property owners on how to properly care for their buildings. And the fact that you do need regular inspections, you need, whether your house is made out of wood, made out of bricks, you need to do the work to take care of it. And in this busy day and age, it can be hard to remember to pencil stuff like that in.
I own one home, and it's hard enough for me to stay on top of it. And it was built in the mid-90s. So I can only imagine when it comes to these older buildings. Tell me, what are some common causes of building collapses? What causes that?
Well, interestingly, you'll note that the buildings that collapsed, you know, so famously in the past few months were all brick. Mm-hmm. And so brick is particularly susceptible to issues because in recent decades, we've been repairing brick in the wrong ways. If you put Portland cement over brick, it traps moisture inside, which leads to rapid deterioration of the brick. Mm-hmm. There have also been sealant products on the market, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that people thought, you know, were strengthening their brick. Everyone thought they were doing a good job by slathering this stuff all over their brick buildings, but actually it was also trapping moisture inside. And we didn't realize that until later. So there are kind of problems that are coming home to roost now, 20 years later, 30 years later, that people really have to be careful if they have a brick building to A, make sure that they don't have materials like paint or Portland cement on top that are going to lead to their deterioration. They need to make sure that they don't gut the inside of their building. We all love open floor plans, but for a brick building, if you don't have interior wall structure holding a brick building up, that's going to cause huge problems. And then sometimes these things are out of our control. Obviously, weather, moisture is harsh here in New Orleans, and the infrastructure is problematic. You know, the building Turner's Hall that fell down on Lafayette Street, it had a huge pothole next to it. And so, you know, hour after hour, trucks would be hitting this pothole, the whole building would shake. You know, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities owns that building, and they've been fantastic property owners. But when you have potholes, when you have construction going on all around you, and it's, you know, causing vibrations in your building, that's a big problem.
When you talk about this sealant thing, is that unique to New Orleans, or is that something around the country where the product was either advertised or suggested the use was improper, or is it just here?
It's not unique to New Orleans, but New Orleans has softer bricks. We have those St. Joe-style bricks. That are different than bricks that were hard fired in other parts of the country. So our bricks are more susceptible to these products that were marketed as strengthening products. So you are going to see these issues in other parts of the country. But again, it's just like we have so many buildings compared to other cities around the country, so many older buildings that we're going to see these issues at a much higher rate just because of the volume of historic structures that we have.
Danielle, I always like to learn stuff, so I got to ask you, tell me about St. Joe bricks and hard-fired bricks. What's the difference, and how do we wind up with St. Joe bricks here? What is it?
It's just the nature of our soil here in New Orleans, here in Louisiana. And so St. Joe bricks, you might see a stamp, St. Joe, mm-hmm. on the bricks as you're walking around downtown in the sidewalks. So next time you're walking around exploring New Orleans, you can look for St. Joe bricks. But that's a very famous brickyard outside of New Orleans that supplied a lot of the building materials during some of the building booms in the early 20th century. And so our soil, when you fire it to make a brick, it's just naturally softer than areas of a country like St. Louis or the Northeast that have naturally harder soils.
The Dickens, you say, as Jed Clampett used to say. Really? So because of the soil that we have here that they use to fire the bricks are softer mm-hmm. than using soil from somewhere else that would make mm-hmm. for a harder brick?
Yeah, it just depends on what minerals are in the ground where you live and those sorts of factors. So.
Man, you know some stuff. You taught me some. I'll be doggone. Thank you. We'll pick it up. We come back with Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center in New Orleans. I didn't know that. 651, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 656, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. And to be clear, you're not going to climb the ladder if you just hang around like moss. You have to improve your skill set. You have to learn. You have to contribute. And you have to constantly educate yourself, as Danielle has done. Let's talk about, when you talk about these open floor plans, I would hope that there's an architect involved when people start gutting these buildings and saying, I want a big, giant room here.
Sometimes there are, but sometimes people just work with contractors, you know, to do housing renovations. And the people at the City of New Orleans Historic District office told me that in the past few years, there have been two shotgun houses that have fallen down mid-renovation because they wanted an open floor plan on the inside.
That's
they started ripping walls out, and
that's nuts.
Bad things happened.
Don't you think? That's crazy?
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So tell me, Danielle, when you look, we had a spate of these, but from the conditions you're describing, it seems like we just got, I hate to use time bombs because that can be a melodramatic thing, but it does seem as though future collapses would not be out of the question. So what do people need to look for, or what does the city do? How do you prevent something like this from happening?
I would recommend that homeowners get an inspection every few years. We tend to think of home inspections as something you just do if you're selling your property or buying a property. But in this city, with our extreme, humidity, termites, the ground is always shifting. We're built on a swamp. It's really important for your building to be regularly assessed, especially after a storm. You know, we think about roofs, and we always talk about roofs. But you got to look at the rest of the building, too. Is there water getting in anywhere? Do you have active termites? Even, brick buildings, people don't think about termites with brick buildings. But the inside, the structure of a brick building is timber. And so there are termites everywhere in this city, and we have to be on top of that problem before it gets too bad. So there are so many environmental factors that really necessitate regular building inspections in this city. And it costs a little bit of money, and that's hard for some people to swing. But if you can swing it, it pays off in the long run, because, when you catch problems early and you're able to address them, it saves you so much money because they don't have the time to blow up into something major.
When it comes to areas of the city, are there some that are more prone to worry than others?
Yeah, the older your building is, the more susceptible it's going to be, because it's been around longer. It's been standing in the elements longer. Mm-hmm. But don't forget that our historic building materials are superior to anything you can buy on the market right now. A shotgun house that's built with sink or cypress, that's wood that was grown in water in a swamp. If you buy brand new growth pine right now and, build yourself a new porch or something, it's going to last 5 to 10 years before it rots. Mm-hmm. So these building materials that our buildings were built with are superior. They've lasted over 100 years. But in order to last another 100 years, we've got to take good care of them.
Thank you, Danielle, for your time. You have to come back, talk about the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans and some of the stuff y'all do in general, okay?
Oh, I'd love that, Tommy. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. You have a great day. Danielle, and nice Mardi Gras. Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation, I'll get it out, Resource Center New Orleans. We come back. Governor Landry laid out his budget for the next fiscal year. We'll take a look at it with Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute, see what he thinks about it. Then we'll see what Jan Moeller thinks of it with the Executive Director of Investment in Louisiana. A lot coming up. Stay with us. WWL. 7:13. We talked with the National Weather Service earlier, in case you missed it, and they're saying that from now until Lundi Gras, delightful weather, just perfect. And then Lundi Gras, Mardi Gras, maybe a chance for rain. It all depends on the timing of it. Could be, ideally, it would work where it rains like Camelot, the night of Lundi Gras and then overnight, and then Mardi Gras is fine, but they'll have to watch it. Naturally, we'll watch it. And either way, they're saying it's not going to be a washout as it stands now, maybe a line of showers or something like that. So as long as it's not a steady all-day rain like it was on Sunday, I think we'll be okay. We're going to talk about the governor's proposed budget here, and we're going to look at both sides of it. We'll begin with Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Then we'll talk with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Investment in Louisiana. I'm sure they have different views on this. And I want to mention, too, that in the next hour, we're going to go to the Vatican, go to Rome, and get an update on Pope Francis's condition, who they say is doing a little bit better. And I think, I don't know that you can jinx a pope or Gregory a pope, but I think he's going to make a full comeback because I think he's got more work to do. With that, we welcome in Daniel Erspammer. How you doing, Daniel?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Doing great. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me about, first of all, when it comes to a budget, how do you know how much we have to spend, or how much does the governor know?
Well, they start with, there's a body called the Revenue Estimating Conference, and that group of economists and legislative leadership decide, they vote on a projection. So they start with a projection, in this case, that was made in December. They will update that in a few months, but the executive budget starts with an update from December.
And the things that are going on in Washington, does that have anything to do with the budget for next year, or do we know yet?
Well, I don't think we know yet. So certainly, the Louisiana budget is quite heavily, 20-some-odd billion of federal funds in the governor's executive budget. So certainly some of those, you know, there are some question marks about where or what will happen with all in D.C. But for the most part, they present a budget based on the information that they have. And then you go from there.
That's kind of a mixed bag, right? Because we all want the deficit or the debt, at least the deficit year to year debt cumulative. We all want that reduced. But yet we also want depend in Louisiana, I guess I should say, on that $20 billion. So how do you navigate that, Daniel? That's a tough road, huh?
It's a really tough road. You know, one of the things we've been calling for over the last several years is more transparency over the receipt of federal funds and an understanding of what the state commits to by accepting the funds. And so there'll be more work to do on that. But if we have more transparency over that, it'll make it easier anyway. It's still not easy, but easier to navigate the changing landscape in Washington.
So what does that $20 billion go for now? Do you know? I'm just curious. The $20 billion we get from the feds.
You know, a big chunk of it goes to Medicaid. The biggest chunk certainly goes into health care in general. Looking at their breakdown, it's about $18 billion of that. Of that $22 billion goes into health care. There's some into transportation infrastructure, certainly some into K-12 education, and then a chunk into our safety net system, which is largely housed right now in the Department of Children and Family Services.
So what is the governor looking to do with the budget that he proposed, and what does the Pelican Institute think of it?
Yeah, so the governor has proposed largely what they call a standstill budget. So if you break down the numbers, it actually leads to a proposed $1 billion decrease year over year in total state funds, excluding the federal government funds. It gets a little complicated, but with what they call carry forwards from previous budget cycles, it goes from about $23 billion in the current fiscal year of state funds only to $22 billion. Again, rounding, obviously, but so you know, it represents some fiscal responsibility. We believe there's still more to be done to constrain recurring spending so that funds free up to invest in roads and bridges and to continue to lower the tax rates, which of course will call for continued work on over the next couple years.
What does that look like? Restrain recurring spending.
Yeah. So if you look at the historical spending numbers, the total budget has grown substantially, even since as recently as 2021. It's grown about $10 billion overall. Now, a big chunk of that is federal money. If you look even longer term, if you go back over the last 20 years, you know, the state budget was just under $20 billion, and now we're talking at just under $50 billion. So what we want to look at there is what is recurring spending. What are the programs and agencies and staffing that we, you know, budget for and spend year after year? The more we can constrain that, the better off we can be in terms of tax relief, in terms of one-time expenditures like roads and bridges. Of course, we know the state is desperately in need of that. So, you know, what we're looking for over time, and this is a very good start to it, is where can we find streamlining? Where can we find efficiencies? Where are programs that may or may not be necessary in the current environment? And how do we make sure we've got the most efficient, effective government the taxpayers are willing to pay for?
Let's talk about that when we come back. If you have anything specifically that you're addressing, we're talking with Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute, about Governor Landry laying out his budget, which is, for the most part, neutral, Daniel. No more spending?
That's right.
Okay, good. And we'll pick it up there when we come back. 720 Traffic Now, WWL. 724 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute, talking about Governor Landry's budget that he laid out for the next fiscal year. Daniel, when it comes to everybody's concern with government waste, and rightfully so, and overspending, and, you know, if you spend money here, you either could have spent it there, or maybe you didn't need to collect it in the first place. What are some of the things the Pelican Institute's looking at?
Yeah, you know, we're digging in pretty deep to the budget over the last few years. You know, there's a few things just off the top. One is we're not very good as a state at projecting Medicaid expenses. And so, you know, as we look for the last few years, we've over budgeted by several hundred million dollars, the Medicaid program. And what happens at the end of the year is they come sweep that money out of Medicaid and spend it on pet projects for the most part. This is
a supplemental bill. Take me through that. So let's slow down a little bit. So they say Medicaid, we project Medicaid's going to cost, pick a number out of the air and then take me from there, Daniel.
Yeah, so just for a round number's sake, let's say it's, you know, we're going to say $100 billion or $100 million.
Right.
It's much more than that,
but no,
for simplification.
Make it $100 if you want, just so people can
Sure.
Pay.
Yeah. That's right. So so they project that, but they only need, if it's $100, let's say they only need 80.
Okay.
And so what happens is toward the end of the legislative session, they begin to, or sometimes later after the legislative session, they realize they don't need that money, but other agencies would like to have it, or the legislature would like to use that money to fund projects in their districts, which is what's happened a lot over the last few years. So money that is, you know, they come and argue, we've got to have this money, we've got to have this money to help kids or to help people, you know, their health, ends up in district spending for the most part, not related to health care.
So it would seem to me, the cynical side of me, Daniel, would say, let's go ahead, and those with political clout, let's go ahead and over budget for Medicaid because it's not going to cost that much, and on the back end, we'll be able to take this for our pet project. Am I being too cynical here? Is that the way it works?
I don't think you are. I think, you know, it has become an easy, you know, slush fund is probably too strong of a word, but it's become an easy place to cushion a little bit because the projections are so imprecise, and it becomes a place where dollars can be pulled out for other spending needs. Or wants in many of these cases. So I don't think you're being overly cynical.
So that's not happening in a vacuum, right? Somebody's got to be approving this, both parties or what?
Oh, absolutely. This is, you know, this is not a partisan question. This gets back to how do we actually prepare a budget? Again, we would recommend starting like many households or businesses do with zero at the beginning of the year and building a budget for the coming year. Now, there's no doubt about it. A $50 billion budget is much more complex than my much, much smaller household budget. But, you know, and so there's definitely complexity to that. I don't want to underappreciate that. What happens is we start with last year's budget and typically add to it. In this case, and kudos to the governor for starting at this place, is he's presented a budget that actually cuts some portion of money. What they did is started with last year's budget, removed any non-recurring expenses or one-time expenses, and then adjusted based on agency recommendations. In their presentation, they said very clearly they asked for agencies to look for places to streamline, look for perhaps career roles that don't need to be refilled or programs that aren't effective anymore. And so we end up with a budget that's in all about $1 billion less than the year before.
And when it comes to putting this money into Medicaid, that should be surfaced during committee hearings, or at some point somebody should have a better handle on this, right?
Absolutely. And look, part of the challenge is, and I understand this, is if someone shows up and enrolls and qualifies for Medicaid, it doesn't matter whether the budget's there or not, they qualify. Mm-hmm. So there is a reasonable argument to at least not underestimate what the Medicaid budget will be, but we got to do a better job projecting.
Very informative, Daniel. Thank you. I appreciate your time. A lot of us don't understand how it works. You bet. Thank you, sir. Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. Interesting about how that can lend itself to shenanigans if you over-budget for Medicaid and then at the end you got money left over. Well, let's see if we can build that whatever it is in my district here and bring home a little bit of the bacon. We'll take a break and back talk to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana, get his thoughts. Tommy Tucker making our way through a beautiful Tuesday morning. week from now, Fat Tuesday. We'll have to see what happens with the weather. Right now, time for WWL First News. All right, 7:45, quarter till 8. We've already heard from Daniel Erspammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. His thoughts on Governor Landry's proposed budget. Jan Moeller joins us now, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. See what they think about it. How you doing, Jan?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Tommy.
Tell me your thoughts about what you know of it so far.
Well, it's important to note that this is just the opening bell in a, well, I don't even want to call it a fight, but in a debate that's going to go on for several months. You know, it could be a lot better, but it also could be a lot worse for a budget. The state, as you know, has to balance its budget every year. We can only spend what we take in taxes. And so state revenues right now are flat, coming in just about the same as they are this year, next year. And that means most programs are flat. So the governor described this as a standstill budget. I think that's what you have. But there's also a little bit more uncertainty surrounding this debate than usual for a couple of reasons. And the main one is we don't know exactly how the tax changes that the legislature passed in November are going to actually play out. The economists can make their best guess of how it's going to affect the economy, but we don't really know for sure. So it could come in on the plus side, but it could also come in on the negative side. So if I were a legislator, I'd be a little bit more nervous than usual going into this budget cycle.
So when it comes to the you're talking about the budget projections with the tax revisions, or does I'm a little bit confused on that part, John?
Yeah. So the legislature, the governor presents an executive budget that's based on the revenue that the state expects to take in. Right. So the economists provide a revenue forecast. They say this is how much we think is going to come in through all the various taxes, through income taxes, through gambling, through sales taxes, what have you. And then the budget that the governor presents is based on that revenue forecast. So it's essentially a guess. And that's why you end up with a surplus some years and you have a deficit and a shortfall other years. And so it's always a little uncertain because you don't know when the economy is going to boom and you don't know when we might have a recession. So the economists do the best job they can to try to guess what the revenue forecast for the state is going to end up like. And that's the part that has more uncertainty because, just a couple of months ago, the state passed a flat income tax rate. We cut income taxes by quite a lot for individuals and for corporations. So we're going to have a lot less corporate and individual income tax revenue coming in. We're going to have a lot more sales tax revenue coming in. We raised the sales tax to pay for some of this. There are some of these changes that depend on the constitutional amendment. So we don't even know exactly how this is going to look until the voters have their say on March 29th. So that's the uncertainty part. And again, this is not a knock on the economists because they do their very best. But we made huge changes to the tax code just a couple of months ago, and we have to see how that plays out.
See, I think that's big what you just said about the amendments that are up on March 29th. The big one is, I guess, like four of them, but the big one is the bigger, larger one, let's put it that way, is about reforming the tax system in the state, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. So Amendment 2 on the March 29th ballot, which we talked about on your show last week, is the one that essentially rewrites the section of the Constitution dealing with taxes and budgets. And so and that's going to have a huge effect. For example, it eliminates a couple of education trust funds. The state spends money out of those trust funds on education mostly on education. If those trust funds goes away, that's a $70 million hole in education that the legislature will have to address. That's not accounted for in the budget. On the other hand, right now, the budget that's presented does not include the stipends that teachers receive. So if the amendment fails, teachers are actually going to see a cut in their net pay that the legislature, I think, would be would need to try to make up. I don't think anybody in that building wants to cut teacher pay. So there's a lot of variables that depend on that constitutional amendment. And then, Tommy, the really big factor in this budget is what happens at the federal level.
Let me take a break, and we'll pick it up there when we come back, because that is the $20 billion question, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. 7:51, 9 till 9. We're 9 till 8, rather. We're previewing the governor's budget. We've already spent some time with Daniel Erzfammer, CEO of the Pelican Institute. You can use the Odyssey Rewind feature. Go back and click at WWL.com on my name and find the audio there. Now we're getting Jan Mueller's thoughts. We'll talk about the dependence on $20 billion coming from the federal government, primarily for Medicaid, and what happens if that disappears when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8. One of the more iconic images in the history of the nation is then Secret Service agent Clint Hill climbing onto the back of the limousine after JFK was shot. He passed away. He died earlier today. He was 93 years old. Just wanted to pass that along. Jan Mueller is our guest, executive director of Invest in Louisiana. As we talk about the governor's proposed budget, there are a couple of wild cards, the constitutional amendment being one of them. The other, $20 billion that the states get for the state gets from the federal government for Medicaid. And to be clear, Jan, the state, just for those that are wondering, Louisiana gets a lot more from the federal government than we pay in. Accurate?
Absolutely. We get about $1.25 back from the federal government for every dollar that we pay in taxes. We get more federal money as a percentage of our budget than any other state. And that's, as you said, mostly due to Medicaid, but also the fact that we get a lot of money for disaster recovery. We're always recovering from multiple disasters at Louisiana, and that is federal dollars that flows through the state. But Tommy, that's when we talk about variables in next year's budget, that is, you know, the 800-pound gorilla of variables, because right now the House of Representatives in Washington has a budget resolution being led by Mike Johnson from Louisiana and Steve Scalise from Louisiana that wants to cut $880 billion out of the Medicaid program. If that were to pass, and we don't know if it will pass, it would have a devastating impact on Louisiana because there is no way you make a cut of that magnitude without really affecting patients and the state economy. You would have to take health care away from Louisianans. Most likely you would end up with a big shock to the budget, but also in a big shock to the availability and accessibility of health care in every community in the state.
So we got the Speaker of the House, we got the Majority Leader in the House. You would think Louisiana would have exceptional power like back in the day, but actually they're pushing programs that would cut federal funding to the state. And I understand we're all concerned about federal debt and deficit, but they're pushing these programs, and then what happens then?
Well, that's the big question. I've heard the president say that he is not in favor of cutting Medicaid. I hope he's good at his word, because if those Medicaid cuts come, it will be devastating for Louisiana communities and for the private providers of Medicaid services. When you talk about the Medicaid program, you're talking about money that pays private doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, clinics, pharmacies. There's a lot of people who go to work every day in Louisiana in the private sector who depend on those Medicaid dollars to pay for the services they provide for patients and families.
Thank you, Jan. We'll see how it plays out. Appreciate your time. We come back, we're going to talk about romance scams. 8:15, we've already spoken to Sean O'Neill at the National Weather Service earlier, and he tells us weather should be pretty nice all the way through Lundy Gras. And then the timing of a front coming through, not all day rain like Sunday or anything like that passed, like Sunday passed, but maybe a squall line of showers or something like that. But it could happen, hopefully, like Camelot, where it happens overnight and doesn't affect anything, maybe even clean the streets up a little bit. So we'll have to see. But between now and Lundy Gras, get out and enjoy it, man. It's going to be nice. Alex Hammerstone joins us now, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec in Cleveland today, Alex, or not?
I am in Cleveland, although I'm jet lagged. I was in Japan last week. So.
What are we looking at in Cleveland today, weather-wise?
It is high of 48. We got a significant snow last week, which is quickly melting, which is just makes a wet mess. So.
Yeah, we found that out last month. Believe me, my friend, it gets dirty and ugly real quick. So a couple of texts come in as we talk about romance scams. A better question would be, do you know anyone who has not been scammed in the name of romance? Touche. Somebody else says, I'm a nail tech in New Orleans. One of my clients got scammed and catfished by a guy that said he was a dermatologist doctor, etc. So I used to watch, wait for the news to come on, and I'd see Dr. Phil, not a fan, but I would be forced to watch it, and I'd see these stories of these old women, that not older women, I shouldn't say that, and men too. It's not just sex, man or woman, but that man, and he'd present them with unequivocal proof that they were being catfished, that this was a scam. Actually bring the person out whose picture had been taken from the internet and used and introduce them, and they still refuse to believe it. What goes on when it comes to these romance scams, Alex? And I'm not trying to get you too far into their heads, but how can people become victimized so easily when it comes to their money?
Well, that's what's interesting is with these scams. So a lot of the scams we talk about, you know, where someone has money stolen or some investment opportunity, when you present them with the evidence, they tend to realize they were scammed and want to get their money back. But with these romance scams, you know, I've worked with a number of kind of local media outlets, you know, where they've presented somebody with all the evidence that they were being scammed. And even if they kind of admit it, that they know they were being scammed, a few months later, they'll be right back with the supposed person.
I mean, they
get so deep into it.
I guess people are lonely, looking for connection. I don't know. I don't know about you, Alex, but when it comes to relationships and money, if I know you and you know, it's hard to get money out of me. Let's just put it that way. I'll leave it at that, let alone online. Tell me some of the scams that are going around.
So one thing that's interesting is that, so the FBI came out, it was just before Valentine's Day, in a tweet saying, you know, this is now a $4 billion a year problem. So it's huge. And, you know, I go to a lot of conferences where the FBI and other law enforcement presents, and they'll talk a lot about how these romance scams are growing extremely quickly. And in short, it's just somebody purporting to be a love interest or a potential love interest and kind of hooking you in and just manipulating you to think that you're having a relationship. And the ultimate goal is to get you to send them money. And there's some consistent things, right? So oftentimes you'll meet them on a dating site or social media, and they'll very quickly want to get you off that dating site, right? They won't want you using their communication methods because the dating sites have ways to kind of detect scams and unusual activity. And then they'll work to kind of love bomb you, and these things can take weeks or months or sometimes even years where they'll build up, you know, your confidence. And, you know, they'll send you pictures, you know, claim to be in love with you. And then they'll start asking for money for various things. You know, commonly they'll ask for plane tickets to come see them or finally meet. And then, of course, something happens where they can't make it, or they'll say their kids have problems. They always have these sob stories. But these are, I said, they're unbelievable because every other kind of scam, you know, when people are kind of, it's pointed out to them, they tend to back off. But these people are really into it.
What are some, let me take a break, we'll pick it up, we come back. I would think people have been scammed that have said this could never happen to me, and it happened to them because of misdirection, etc. We'll talk of some of the things to look out for and also some of the warning signs if your parents or maybe parent who is either a widow, divorced, or whatever tells you about somebody they met online and this and that and the other thing, and before you know it, they're out a whole bunch of money. Total, how much does the nation, do you have a total? Well, how many, like, dollars are lost on scams?
The FBI, as I said, they came out and said it was around $4 billion, which, you know, that's just a huge number.
And I know crypto plays a part in this as well. We'll talk about that when we return, talking to Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec, about romance scams. People aren't just stealing your heart, stealing your money. 820 traffic now, WWL. Hi, Tommy Tucker, WWL 825, talking to this nail technician, not nail tech, she might own the place. I don't know, Maya is her name, but about her client that got scammed. For people that have clients like that, that tell them stories, for people that have family members, what are some of the warning signs where people might drop little hints? I met somebody online or this or that or the other thing. How do you go about uncovering that, Alex?
So it's tough, right? Because, I mean, Look, I've got friends who are in their 60s who have, you know, accomplished, beautiful, you know, 30-year-old spouses, right? I mean, so, you know, so telling people that, you know, if it's somebody that seems too good to be true, it's, you know, it's not real. But certainly take it slow. And I think the most important piece of advice is never, ever send money to somebody that you've never met in person, right? So just if it's someone you meet online and they ask you for money and you've never met them, don't send them money. Now, that's not to say people don't scam in person as well, but that would solve a lot of the issues. And then it's tough, too, just because, again, you know, people have all kinds of relationships. But, you know, if you've spent your whole life kind of dating one type of person and suddenly, you know, some supermodel is interested in you, it may throw up a red flag, right? So really trust your gut on these things. But it's just, again, when it comes to these romance scams, it's the one time when it's almost impossible to talk sense into people. You know, usually people will listen to reason, they'll look at evidence, but once their hearts are kind of involved, all bets are off and off.
So tell me about cryptocurrency, about what is it, pig butchering, some things that people can look out for when they're being lured in?
So cryptocurrency oftentimes kind of makes an appearance in a lot of different scams, right? And the reason is if I make a transfer to you using a legit, you know, a legitimate banking app or send you a credit card payment or something like that, that's all traceable, right? Crypto oftentimes allows for an untraceable way to send money. And so that's why scammers will oftentimes use it, and how crypto kind of gets tied up into the into kind of the dating and romance scam realm. Now, there are oftentimes people that will be, however, you know, looking to, outside of just romance scams, steal your crypto. Again, because it's less traceable and in many cases untraceable. And these scams can be unbelievable. So you'll actually have certain people that will set up fake websites that will kind of show your investment. They'll ask you to invest some money. They'll have this fake website show that your investment is increasing, you know, 10% a week or something. And then they'll ask you for more money based on that. And of course, you believe that your investment's doing well, so you send them more money and then they disappear. So really, it's just, there's just so many different scams out there right now, and people fall for them all the time.
Somebody texted in, this is not about romance, I guess, unless they love bourbon. They say they got scammed online, $800 trying to buy bourbon from a website. Is that something you've heard of, or is that just part and parcel of the whole package?
Absolutely. So there are, you know, it's one of the things I think you and I have talked about a number of times, right? One of the ways that people will scam you is to have a hard-to-get product, and they'll offer it on a very realistic-looking website, and then, you know, the product doesn't exist. Of course, that's different than just kind of basic consumer issues with bad customer service or, you know, certain companies just aren't good at fulfilling things and are dishonest. So a lot of these things kind of overlap. But certainly when there's something hard to find, I know there are a lot of these bourbon releases that, you know, people get really excited for, and scammers will take advantage of that excitement as well.
More like Pepe Van Scam.
Yeah, that's all right.
Alex, so thank you. I appreciate it. So bottom line, if it's too good to be true, it is. There's no free lunch. If you're swinging way above your weight, chances are it's not real. And don't ever, ever send anybody money when it comes to, well, we're going to talk to a clinical neuropsychologist in the next hour. I'll ask her about the, you know, when it comes to dating people and money, when that comes up, I'd be, again, suspicious of doing it in person, let alone online. So let that always be a warning to you. Thank you, Alex. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll go to Rome, rather, and get an update on Pope Francis's condition from the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. 8:30 time for WWL First News. 8:47, 13 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Christopher White, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Good morning, Christopher. How are you?
I'm well, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
You are in Rome, I believe, right?
I am, yes, at the Vatican.
I was fortunate enough to go, and I think everybody that prizes art, prizes religion, prizes history should go to Rome and the Vatican at least once. Tell me about Pope Francis. What do we know?
Well, Pope Francis has been in hospital for 12 days. He's 88 years old and battling double pneumonia. The Vatican is describing his condition as critical, but they said yesterday that he's had a slight improvement, but at the same time, it's too soon to predict a prognosis. We know that some of his blood results have shown some signs of improvement as well. But again, they've been giving this Pope a lot of drugs to try to treat the double pneumonia, and it seems to be taking a toll on his other organs. So very much a delicate situation.
And how old is he, Christopher?
He's 88 years old, and even before going into hospital, he has a number of underlying health issues. He's had limited mobility in recent years, which has led to quite a bit of weight gain, and he has chronic bronchitis. So these make treating the double pneumonia even more complicated.
But put this in context for me, because I think sometimes we take a papacy for granted, but sometimes lose context on it, because we tend to think that the man that wears the white robes is always the same, when in fact, obviously, it's different people. Take me back to when Francis became Pope.
Well, Francis was elected in 2013, and it was a bit of a different time, because he became Pope after a papal resignation. That hasn't happened in over 600 years. Typically, and historically, popes have ruled for life. So when he was elected in 2013, he came in on a reform mandate and really focused his papacy on sort of bringing the church into dialogue with the modern world. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, he's been in office for 12 years, and he's had a longer papacy than he himself anticipated. Early on, he said, "I think I'll have a short papacy, 4 or 5 years, and then I'm going to God." Well, we've gone now double that. And even so, at 88 and in hospital battling all of these health crises, he seems to have some fight left in him. This is a Pope who likes to surprise people. And so you have to take the doctor's words very seriously. This is a grave health crisis, and the Pope is not out of danger. That being said, he's determined.
And you say he's a fighter, and he is, and he's fighting infections right now. But when it comes to his papacy, what have been some of the fights that he's taken on, and with whom?
Well, for starters, I'd say he's made the Catholic Church, refocus its priorities. We've seen migration and climate change sort of top his list of concerns, whereas in the past two papacies, issues such as family and gender and sexuality were issues that sort of bubbled up to the top. And for Pope Francis, it's not as if he's overhauled church doctrine or changed teaching on any of those things. He's just shifted the focus. And that, of course, has rankled some of his conservative critics who see him as perhaps undoing longstanding church tradition, or perhaps, shifting the balance away from what they would prefer. And that has, of course, garnered him some enemies, but it's also, I think it's fair to say, garnered him favor as well.
I think it's interesting because while the Pope does talk of inclusivity, nothing really changed, right?
Well, Pope Francis has not overhauled any doctrine. I think it's just fair to say his pastoral priorities as Pope has changed. And I think for some people that has been a shock to the system. Because both the papacies of John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI, which really ran, almost half a century if you combine the two, people had gotten accustomed to a certain way of doing things. Francis was the first pope from the global south. He was a Jesuit. That was a historic first. And he is a bit of a maverick. He has done things his own way. And for an institution that is very reticent and reluctant to change, Francis has been unafraid to sort of rattle the branches and do things differently.
He will not be Pope forever, naturally. We all are mortal people. But when it comes to the next Pope, is the church likely to take, or are those inside saying it's likely to take a more conservative turn, or not necessarily? Thoughts on that?
Well, Pope Francis has named two-thirds of the men who will one day elect his successor. These are the church's cardinals who, when a pope dies or resigns, it falls to them to elect among themselves the successor as the next pope. And by naming two-thirds of the men, he's left a strong imprint on the College of Cardinals. But that doesn't guarantee that the next pope who emerges will be identical to Francis and share his same opinions and preferences and priorities. But it does mean that there's a greater likelihood that someone will emerge that this pope has put into a position of power because the pope sees something in them that he respects.
Do we know, Christopher, or does anybody know, once they go behind those sealed doors, how political the process is, what kind of buttonholing there is, if there's any trading of votes or anything like that with a conclave whenever one happens?
Well, of course, conclave is in the news right now because of the Hollywood film that's getting a lot of buzz. I like the film quite a bit, but I have to say it's entirely unrealistic. That being said, of course, the Vatican is a political institution, not just a spiritual one. And there are backroom conversations, and, you know, they will, when they go behind closed doors, be sizing each other's up. That being said, I mean, it's all sort of framed by the spiritual context in which this takes place, in an atmosphere of prayer and discernment. But that doesn't mean there isn't lobbying that's done, that there aren't conversations and blocks that emerge.
Campaigning?
Pardon?
Campaigning?
Well, campaigning is expressly forbidden, but we certainly, you know, you certainly do have rival camps. And I think it's fair to say the next conclave, whenever that is, whether it's next week, next year, or in 10 years from now, it will be a referendum on the Francis papacy. And those who want to see a candidate emerge that is in continuity with Francis, or someone that charts a different course.
Thank you, Christopher. I appreciate your time. I really do. Real quick, the feeling you get there in Vatican City, I guess you've been to St. Peter's Square, is what?
At the moment, I'd say there's a lot of, it's a tense atmosphere, a lot of uncertainty. We see a number of pilgrims that are here, just like yourself, you know, some time back, that wanted to be here and pray, because this is a holy year. And right now, I would say most of their prayers are going toward the health of Pope Francis and his recovery. So it's buzzing with energy, but that energy certainly comes with a lot of anxiety at the moment.
Thank you, Christopher. I appreciate your time. I really do, and your insight. Christopher White, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Conclave is a movie. It's also the process by which they elect a new pope. And if you've seen the movie, and I haven't, I think it's a great film, I would also suggest maybe The Shoes of the Fisherman, which is a much older movie with Anthony Quinn that also addresses the election and nomination of a new pope, a different take on it. But I would say if you look at the two of them, maybe you'll get a balance somewhere. 855, 5 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Into the 9 o'clock hour we go, 9:09, and hearing that Pope Francis, and look, God bless him, man, because you know at 88, and having been through it with elderly parents that were very ill, it's hard to fight back from something like that and not just give up. And just, you know, anybody who's been through knee replacements or any kind of thing like that knows, or any accident, or you got to go through the rehab to get your strength back and everything else, and God bless him to do that. And he had a meeting today about new saints, and I'm just thinking, maybe Patrick Mahomes in a black and gold? That wouldn't be a bad idea. A couple of linebackers, corners, people can rush a passer. While you're at it, Pope Francis, if you can. Of course, we probably just kind of wandered into miracle range. But Matt Range joins us now, author of The Big Book of King Cake. How you doing, Matt? Happy Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you too. I'm doing great. I'm excited for some parades. How are you, Tommy?
I'm good. You know what I'm thinking? Kind of like, I don't know if I addressed this last time with you or not, but kind of like Kramer, but it would be a king cake book that actually is a king cake. What do you think? It's edible.
I think you might have actually mentioned this last time, because at least somebody did, and it seems like it might be something that you came up with. It's a good idea.
It does sound like something I would come up with, and again, the memory's not what it used to be, so maybe I did mention it, but and think of the books you'd sell.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah,
see,
I thought
because,
about doing like a king cake advent calendar or something like that in the month leading up to it, which would be delicious also.
But if the book was a king cake, you would eat it when you finished reading it, and then you'd have to do what? Buy another
king cake book.
Tell me about your book, seriously, because it is, did you update it at all, and have you discovered any new king cakes? Tell me about your journey.
Okay, so the book is now in its fourth print run, so there were some kind of minor updates, but really most of my time, right, I'm creating the Big Book of Po'boy right now, so that's where most of my efforts are. I'm always trying new king cakes, and so definitely probably like, I don't know, 10 years from now, maybe I'll do a big update. But the book itself is kind of meant to be a snapshot of king cake in one specific time, and so it features 75 different New Orleans bakeries and the stories behind each of their unique king cakes with, you know, 1,000+ beautiful photographs, you know, amazing stories about how each of these bakers and their own personal journey led to their unique, specific, original type of king cake. And so, for example, a Honduran bakery who, you know, wanted to create some sort of Honduran version of Louisiana's king cake tradition, so put some guava and cream cheese inside. Or like the story behind Dongfang's bakery and how their king cake, why it has those ridges, it's because she was a seamstress before she came to New Orleans after the Vietnam War. So there's lots of great stories in the book as well.
I kid you not, and I talk about Maurice French pastries, but I clicked on the big book of king cake and I just clicked on an image and it turned out to be Jean-Luc Albin's page about Maurice French pastries, and you have a quote in there from him saying, if I was back in France and I could only make two types of king cakes, I probably would have changed careers. That's part of the story as well, right? About the different bakers and how they were inspired to do these kinds of things?
Yeah, exactly right. That's kind of what, so when I started creating the book, I thought it was going to be just a book about these beautiful cakes. It kind of, my personal story is that one year I was invited to a king cake party, and this was before I was a writer. I ended up eating 88 different kinds of king cake just in preparation to figure out which king cake I wanted to bring. And so I kind of carried that over into the creation of the book, thinking, oh, this is just about, like, look at these cool different kinds of king cake. But as I started to interview bakers like Jean-Luc, I was like, oh, my God, each of these bakers has such an incredible story. None of these, this sushi king cake, for example, or Jean-Luc's French style of king cake, they're all based on their own personal stories. And so I kind of got obsessed with that idea. And here in Louisiana, we're really, there are king cake traditions, and I talk about this history in the book as well, all across Europe, as well as in Mexico, there are, all of these different countries have a version of king cake, and they, you know, look a little bit like ours, but kind of different. They have different names, but it all translates to kind of cake of kings, roughly. But the unique thing about Louisiana king cake is we're the only ones who tie it to Carnival and Mardi Gras rather than Christmas, and we're the only ones who allow for this huge amount of creativity that other places kind of don't. They have their one traditional kind, and that's it. We have obviously our traditional kind too, and I think it's really fun that we have this battle between, you know, traditionalists who love that Mackenzie style king cake, and then people who are willing to kind of maybe try to evolve a little bit. And through that, I think we get a really fun season of king cake eating.
I saw somebody on social media the other day post a picture of the traditional drier king cake with the phrase warning choking hazard, which I thought was funny, however not very nice, but it can be kind of dry. It comes to the Mexican type, I think I saw one of these maybe at Rouse's at the beginning of the season with like a yellow, gold, and black icing or something like that. Does that make sense to you? They called it something besides a king cake, and it did appear to be in Spanish.
Oh, interesting. So in Mexico and Spain, it's called the Roscón de Reyes or the Rosca de Reyes.
That's what it
which
was.
Again translates to Cake of Kings. And their tradition is so interesting. And so it's on January 6th and only January 6th, you know, the 12th night of Christmas, which is where our king cake used to be. The same thing in Louisiana. You'd only eat king cake on January 6th. But in Mexico, that's still the case. And they have a plastic baby inside the king cake as well. Here in Louisiana, there's a little bit of a debate about whether the baby is meant to be baby Jesus or not. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, it's unanimously agreed on that it's baby Jesus. And so you, whoever gets the baby inside the Rosca de Reyes, hangs on to that baby. And on February 2nd, which is, you know, in the Bible is when Mary would have brought Jesus to church for the first time. Mm-hmm. You are meant to bring baby Jesus to church on a day that's called Candlemas. And then you host a tamale party on that day on February 2nd. So it's kind of a different tradition, but same general idea.
What about just the history of this? Because for people, you know, we got people moving in the area all the time. They got people shipping king cakes all the time. And maybe we don't quite realize what it is that we're doing or how this all started. Give me the quick history of king cake, the 2-minute version, if you can.
Yeah, sure. And so it goes all the way back to ancient Rome. And so a lot of people say that king cake, they believe it began in France. The ancient Romans were doing something very similar, though it wasn't about Mardi Gras and it wasn't called a king cake. It was celebrating the Saturnalia, which was basically in the months leading up to December 21st, the winter solstice, which is when Saturnalia was celebrated. The sun was, in their viewpoint, the Romans believed that the sun was dying. You know, it was getting lower in the sky at its apex every day. The nights were getting longer, days getting shorter. But on December 21st, winter solstice, that all turns around. The sun is rising higher in the sky each day. Days are getting longer. And so they saw that as the return of the sun, S-U-N. And so that was worthy of a celebration. They'd eat too much, drink too much, wear colorful costumes, parade in the street. And in the middle of their feast, they'd have a cake that was round like the sun and circular like the sun. Think kind of like the Galette des Rois, the French version of king cake. Mm-hmm. And inside that cake would be a fava bean. And whoever got the slice of the cake with that fava bean inside would be crowned king or queen of the Saturnalia, similar to what we do now. You're crowned king or queen of your classroom or your break room, and you have to buy the next king cake. But in Rome, you didn't have to buy the next king cake. Rather, you were sacrificed to the gods. So it was a much higher stakes thing. That eventually spreads out around all across Europe. Christianity kind of takes the tradition over, and they make it about Christmas time, the 12th night of Christmas, and celebrating the three kings.
If you could use your imagination, because you've tried, how many did you different types of cakes have you tried total?
At this point, probably 300 and something, I would guess, something like that. Many, many.
So if you could create one of your own, going back to what Jean-Luc said, what would you like to see? Where do you see king cakes going, Matt? Because you wrote you want to talk about the little book as well, but tell me, where do you see this going?
This is great. I've never been asked this question, the king cake that I would create. So I'm a New Yorker originally, which makes people, you know, gasp and frown sometimes. But, you know, fell in love with New Orleans and fell in love with king cake, and I've been here for 16 years. But, you know, I loved three colored cookies were like my favorite thing. Those rainbow cookies, you know, which my mom would always have on Long Island around the holidays. And so I always said that I would want to make a three color cookie king cake, maybe with that, you know, flavoring inside, and then maybe some three color cookies on top. But then I saw this year somebody actually created it, this place, Balboni's King Cakes. They made a three-colored cookie king cake, and it's awesome. So.
Is it the same as like a black and white cookie? Because there you go. What about a black and white king cake, like a black and white cookie?
It's a great idea, and I've not seen anybody do that, so that's a really good idea, too. You're full of them today.
Hey, I am. I'm full of a lot of stuff. Tell me about the Little Book of King Cake.
Sure. So the Little Book of King Cake. So basically, I for years have taught this after-school program. And I teach these third graders and, you know, creative writing. And so after I wrote the Big Book of King Cake, I brought it to them. I thought they'd be like, holy cow, Mr. Matt, you're the coolest guy. You wrote this book. But I forgot that third graders are pretty mean.
Yeah.
And so one of them was like, why would you write a whole book about king cake?
Really?
So I was like, okay. Yeah.
Seriously?
So I was like, yeah.
So you're walking in all full of yourself, feeling pretty good, right? I'm Matt Haynes. Yeah, Little Book of King Cake. I'll go ahead and read for the kids. Why would you write a whole book about king cakes?
I know. I got humbled, but then it kind of gave me the idea, oh, maybe it's something that we kind of take for granted a little bit. And so I thought, let me write this kid's book about what makes king cake special. And it's the story of Miley. She's a third grader, and she gets the king cake baby at school. So she has to bring the next king cake, but there are so many different kinds. How could she decide which one to bring? In her dreams, the king cake baby gets real big, flies her around to seven real New Orleans bakeries, and at each bakery, the king cake tells her kind of what makes their version of king cake special, whether it's tradition or the history or the special fillings and things like that.
One thing I did want to ask you about is, what do people tell you about the book? I'm sure you've gotten some feedback on it. The big book.
Yeah.
Or either one.
I've sold now, at this point, you know, 23,000 copies in the last couple of years. And so people seem to love it. You know, it's fun. My favorite thing that I see some people do as they get really obsessed with it is they will take it around to all of the different bakeries and have the baker sign them.
Oh, that's a good
idea. They kind of use it as a guide. And that makes me feel great, because part of the reason of the book is a celebration. You know, the big reason of the book is it's a celebration of the city's bakers and their creativity. And when people use the book to celebrate them, that makes me feel really good.
Anything surprise you when you're writing a book, doing a research about the king cakes, a genuine surprise or inspiration from a baker?
I mean, for me, the biggest surprise was just the unbelievable, you know, history behind the cake. But then also, I think, you know, as a journalist, it's something that I've really kind of adopted now as something that I think about when I'm interviewing people, is that just these stories, like the things that the Tran family from Dongfang Bakery had to go through before they started their bakery, or the things that Martha Gilreath at Nolita Bakery had to go through before she was able to start her bakery. And she was addicted to drugs and homeless, and now she's on the Today Show and winning all these awards with her king cake, all of these amazing journeys. and how it's these stories that every single king cake has a story behind it. I was so surprising to me.
Well, and that's what I love about the book, because like you, I think everybody has a story. And if you ask the right questions, everybody's story is interesting. Really, everybody has an interesting story. Believe it or not, they do. Tell me about the Bow Boy book. How's that coming? And what kind of research? Well, first off, what size pants do you wear? You got to be like in a 48 waist or something. How do you handle all this?
When I just tried those 88 king cakes, mm-hmm. I was single. And I just was like, oh, I'm going to only eat king cake. Mm. And so
wait, calorically,
I was
diet?
Fine.
Did you do the king cake and beer diet? Was that you or was that somebody else?
It sounds like what I was doing. It was basically, calorically, I was okay. Health-wise, I'm sure it was terrible.
That was you that was doing it. I remember that now. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. And then when I did the book, and now with the Po' Boy book also, my girlfriend is like, maybe you should eat like a salad in addition to these king cakes. And those extra calories are kind of really screwing me over here because I'm definitely gaining some weight. Also, I think my metabolism is getting slower.
Yeah, well, it happens as you get older. Matt, I hate to tell you that, but it does happen.
Yeah.
Maybe some aerobic activity too. You know, maybe hit the gym or something. Couldn't hurt.
I try to go for a jog in Ottoman Park most days, so that helps too.
Tell me when the Po' Boy book is going to come out, or do you have a date yet?
Yeah, it should be around November 1st. We're kind of in the home stretch. I was just in here doing some writing, before I jumped on here.
Before we run out of time, give me a preview of an interesting story you've heard in your research for the Po' Boy book.
Yeah, so like at Shortstop Po' Boys out in Metairie, it was such an interesting thing because I've heard this story now a couple of times that they were basically a grocery store before they became a Po' Boy shop. But and back when they were a grocery store, construction workers would come in and one guy would buy a French loaf of bread. One guy would buy a head of lettuce and some tomatoes. One guy would buy a can of mayonnaise. One guy would buy some cold cuts. And they'd all sit on out in the parking lot together and just put their po' boys together themselves.
No.
Now, as big grocery stores started to pop up, those smaller groceries couldn't really compete with them. And so that's when places like Shortstop started to shift to making their own po' boys and then eventually just becoming a straight-up po' boy shop. And so stories like that have been really fun to hear and learn about and put things into context for myself as I'm doing the book.
Everybody's got an interesting story. Matt Haynes, good at telling them. Matt, if people want to order a book, can they order from you and you'll sign it, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. If they go to www.thebigbookofkingcake.com, you can order either of the two books, and eventually the Po' Boy book will be up there as well. And then there's an area for you to write down that you want me to sign and personalize, and I'm happy to do it before I ship it to you, or we can do like a local pickup or something.
That's awesome. It's thebigbookofkingcake.com.
That's right. Exactly right.
Thank you, sir. A pleasure as always. Happy Mardi Gras.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you soon, Tommy. Thank you.
Go run. 9:24, back in a flash with Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist. We're going to talk about a new recent survey showing a third of Americans felt burnout at their job in the past year. Have you, and how do you deal with it? Back in a flash, WWL. Well, it just so happened the name of this song is Psychotic Reaction. We didn't do it on purpose, but we're going to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of The New Rules of Attachment and Stop Self-Sabotage, mother of Luca, 5'7" of brains and beauty and brawn, and a mother of Luca. And I don't know, I'm running out of things to say here. Dr. Judy, how you doing?
We're laughing.
I know.
Hey, Luca
asked why we're laughing.
Let's say hi to Tommy. Say hi, Tommy.
Hey, Luca. How you doing, buddy?
He's good. He just woke up. So he's a little sleepy. You know, can't give toddlers coffee yet. So.
No. Well,
I am enjoying coffee, but yeah, no, I don't want to give this kid coffee. He's so hyper already.
You'd be sorry. Then again, you can always offset with some cough syrup. I'm just kidding. You don't ever want to do that. Let's talk about, we're going to talk about burnout, but earlier we had somebody on talking about scams and romance scams online and so forth. And I just thought it'd be interesting to ask you about when it comes to dating and appropriateness of money and warning signs, when somebody asks you for money, how do you navigate that whole thing? If you got a relationship with somebody, unless you're married or something or sharing funds, I don't know how you handle all of that. Take me through that. You're the licensed clinical neuropsychologist.
Yes, it's so hard. I think that it's very, very hard to navigate. And I think most people would probably agree it's not a good idea to get entangled in finances and loaning, borrowing from friends and family members as much as you can avoid it, only because it tends to cause a lot of friction. Oftentimes it ends in resentment. So I think you just have to have a really clear boundary. Like, what is your financial boundary? Are you willing to help somebody out up to a certain amount? You know, are you just not willing to loan anyone money ever? Kind of have a clear vision in your head, because at some point you'll probably be asked, you know, and so it's just good to know. I know some people, and I think I myself am included in that, I'm more comfortable for sure loaning money to people than I am asking people for money. Mm-hmm. But the problem is sometimes when I loan people money, it's really awkward when I have to ask for it back. So if you think that you're going to be that person and it's going to be hard for you to get your money back, then you might just have to reshift it in your mind. Like, let's say that somebody wants to loan $500 from you and it's a really close family member or a good friend. If you're that person, you may just have to say, okay, it's almost as if I'm not going to get this money back. It's like I'm giving them a gift. And if I never get it back, then I'm okay with it. You know, so you just have to decide what you're truly okay with, what you're not, because I've seen this really tear apart families and friendships.
Let me, I want to open that Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line here at 504-260-1870. And let me know if anybody's either asked you for money, a friend or relative, or if you've asked to borrow money, because I'm thinking, Dr. Judy, I don't know that anybody's ever asked me to borrow money.
Oh, interesting.
Maybe they knew the answer was no, or they knew I'm always broke. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know.
Maybe they're like, he's not going to give us any money. I can tell.
Right. But generally speaking, when it comes to a relationship, if you're starting to date somebody, if they ask you for money, mm-hmm. that should be a big warning time, should it not?
I think so. Yeah, I do think so. And I think that you don't want to be a sucker, right? So maybe it's just that you, Tommy, you just wear your boundaries, you know, more clearly. Some people just kind of look like, oh, well, you know, sure, I'll be a pushover. I'll give it to, you know, maybe you're just not that person. People ask you for other things, but not for actual money for that reason. And I think that sometimes when you're in an early dating relationship and that conversation goes right to borrowing money, of course, that's a warning sign. It doesn't matter how much money you have or how little. The fact that they're already making it transactional at such an early stage, I don't think that that's necessarily a good roadmap for a long-lasting, loving relationship, because you would hope that this person has other people in their life who they have more solidified relationships with, whether it's family members, good friends, or very good colleagues, where if they were in a pinch, they'd be asking those individuals because that relationship is much more established.
You know, somebody
I do think that's a sign.
Somebody texted this in, and I think it's a good point that you should never, ever begin dating anybody with serious credit problems because inevitably, or serious debt, because inevitably it is going to come back and affect the relationship. Thoughts?
I feel like obviously you have to make sure you don't make too many lists of no's before you even give the relationship a chance. But if you do learn that the person has a lot of financial debt, I mean, that means that you probably have to bump up the timeline for when you're going to have that conversation about financial values, right? Because for a relationship to work, you have to have similar values in a lot of different ways, whether it's about family, how you spend your time, you know, all of those things are important to talk about. You know, sometimes for people, religion and spiritual beliefs, that's important to discuss. But the financial discussion is always awkward and people delay it a lot. But eventually, it's going to cause friction. And if you know that they're in debt or you see the way that they spend your concerns, you might have to have that conversation a little earlier so that you really understand the full picture. And whether or not you can get on the same page eventually, I mean, if this is a person who's saying, look, I've made some dumb decisions in my youth. I'm trying to get, you know, financially solvent now. If they have a clear plan, I think that that's fine. You know, you can talk through that. You might have to stay on top of them a little bit. But they're continuing to spend money, being really just reckless with it. I do think that if you guys end up in a long-term relationship, you will have to assume that financial responsibility sooner or later. And I know that one of my best friends, you know, him and his spouse, they both went to grad school. He was able to keep his financial
loans to a minimum, but hers was actually very high. It was a six-digit number, and he didn't realize that until they got married. And there was that did cause resentment in the relationship for at least a few months, because now him making all these responsible financial decisions, now it was his job to get both of them out of debt because now they're married. And, you know, he's the only one who was able to do it out of the two of them. And he didn't learn that until after they got married, right? So just have that conversation early so you know what you're getting into.
Let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about burnout, and you can ponder this during the break. I've been divorced 12 years. At no point did anybody ever say, you know what, Tommy, you'd be perfect for, or you know what, Tommy would be perfect for you. 938, 22 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 944, 16 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We are always concerned about mental health here, so we, every couple of weeks, talk to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Dr. Judy, this study says that nearly a third of Americans felt burnt out at their job in the past year. How do you describe, that's not a clinical diagnosis, right? Burnout, or is it?
Yeah, burnout is not a clinical diagnosis, but it overlaps with other diagnoses, especially depression. So sometimes people have a difficult time determining if it's just burnout or if they're also then slipping into maybe a clinical depression. But either way, what we know is that chronic burnout has a lot of deleterious mental health and physical health effects. And so essentially, if you have chronic burnout, you are going to increase your risk to a host of medical and psychological concerns, which is why it's so important to notice it and address it.
Is it inevitable, burnout?
I don't think it's inevitable, but I do think that it's very common. So if you, depending on the research that you look at, it looks like about 3/4 of Americans who are working, because we're talking about occupational burnout, at some point will say that they have been burnt out some of the time or most of the time. So that's a big statistic, right? It's basically 3 out of 4 people are going to experience this, not just a few days a week from time to time. They're either going to feel like, well, probably half the time I'm feeling burnt out or most of the time I am. And that, I think, is a really big statistic to pay attention to.
Maybe I'm old school here, but I always, you know, and I told my kid the same thing. It's like, well, you know, if it's fun, you pay them to do it, right? But if they pay you, well, then it's going to be a grind. And I don't care what you do, if you're Patrick Mahomes or if you're Tiger Woods or if you're Florence Pugh, I don't know, give me an actress, anybody, no matter what you do, what do you do, Dr. Judy? No matter what you do, at some point it becomes a grind. Don't you have those days?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love my job overall, but it's called a job for a reason. I think that's what you were implying.
Right.
And I think that you have to have expectations that, oh my goodness, Luca is yawning at our conversation. He's like, oh, this is a bore. I don't have to work. But yeah, I think that
get ready, buddy. Your time's coming.
Exactly. Yeah. Enjoy these years. But, you know, I think that maybe especially the younger generation, at least just from what I'm observing, of course, this is great that you want to hope for a career that is inspiring, that you love. But I think that sometimes that sentiment goes overboard and people start getting really disillusioned because they think that they're supposed to love their job all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that if the expectations were set in such a way that, hey, you know what, I do enjoy what I do, but there's going to be days or certain activities that I have to do as part of my job that I don't enjoy doing. If you can just set your expectations in a more realistic place, I actually think that that's one of the secrets to reducing burnout, because burnout has 3 main components. One is emotional exhaustion, like just feeling like no matter how much rest, how much sleep you actually get, you just feel tired. Another one is feeling like you're not as good at your job, even if people are telling you you're good. You just don't feel like you're being very effective. And then the third one, which I think in some ways can be the most insidious one that people don't notice, is that you start to have this really cynical way of looking at your job, your life, the people that you're working with, and you just start to distance yourself from empathy and from really connecting. And I think that that's the one that is the most gradual that people don't see, but it has some of the worst side effects. And I think that people tend to feel that way when they start to think,
well, this job is supposed to be fun all the time. Why is it not always fun? And then you just start distancing yourself from all the goals that you've set. And I think that that's just an important thing to realize, is that no matter what amazing job that you're calling, there's going to be some people you don't like dealing with, some parts of the job that you don't like, and that's so normal.
Somebody texted in about having a grown child that's in the 20s, having a hard time deciding what they want to do, and is there a way to go through a discernment process that would prevent possible burnout, and how do you help counsel somebody or advise them as to what their, I don't know if I'm going to use the word vocation, or what it is that they're determining what they want to do in life, or what they're meant to do, or how do you go about that? Because you got to balance it with, you know, you got to enjoy it, but you still got to be able to provide for yourself and your family as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I would say that it's really helpful to take some established career inventories or personality tests to try to help them to know what their interests are and where their skills are. So a couple of the most famous ones that are used all the time that anyone can have access to, I mean, of course, you have to pay on the website to take the inventory, and then they give you essentially a breakdown and analysis, as well as job descriptions and suggestions for which jobs you might be the most interested in or your skills would be the best equipped to. One of the most famous ones is called the Strong Interest Inventory. Again, anyone can get access, can just search it in Google. Another one is called the Kierzy Assessment. That also helps you to understand how your personality traits might contribute to certain types of work environments. So Kierzy is spelled K-E-I-R-S-E-Y. I think those two things are great. You know, I would also say that, as we were just talking about, Tommy, especially the younger generation, they're having a harder time with this discernment process. I feel like the older generation is just like, well, you got to get a job and you got to work and put food on the table. And then gradually now it's like, well, I don't want to commit to a job until I feel like it's absolutely the right one for me. And guess what? You're not going to feel like that probably with your first or second or third or even your fifth job, right? The whole point is just to dig in, find out what you like and don't like, get experience, meet people, make connections, and then go to your next job. So it's okay if that first step isn't going to be your forever step. But I think that sometimes people get decision paralysis, like I'm supposed to find my calling right now. And then, of course, in this day and age, there's a lot of different other jobs that just weren't open to us before, like YouTube creator. Like, that wasn't a thing when I was younger. You know, so people are sometimes also thinking, well, maybe I can skip a couple steps and just achieve internet fame. And that also takes away from their ability to just say, just got to do a little bit of the grind, just dip your toe in, see if you like it. If you don't, move on. And that's totally normal to be feeling like that and in their 20s. But if these tools might assist the Strong and the Kierzy, then definitely check those out. And you can use those when you're older too. You know, if you're like kind of thinking about a second career, or maybe you're moving into retirement, you're like, oh, what kind of hobbies should I take on? Those are good assessments for that too.
And I've said this often, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I want to do this job till I die. It's what I've always wanted to do. And I was blessed and fortunate and lucky enough to have it and to get it and to hold on to it. But have there ever been studies done about how many people, when all is said and done, when they get to retirement age or whatever, that they look back with regret or they look back with satisfaction?
Yeah, that's just such a good question. I'm going to look up to see if there's any recent studies on that and get back to you. But, you know, I think that
anecdotally,
it's actually higher than you think.
I was going to say anecdotally.
Yeah, I would say that the number is higher than you think. I think that sometimes people think, oh, well, if I look back, I'm going to have all these things that I wish I had done instead. But I think that from what I hear and from what I see, most people have a lot about their lives that they can look back that they're satisfied by. It might not be career, right? It might be something else. It might be that they're satisfied about how they spent their time on the weekends, or how they were with their family, or how they pursued their hobbies. But I think that more people than you would think are satisfied with how they chose to spend their lives and who they spent it with.
All right, they're getting up and we're getting ready to walk out of church. Leave them with a thought, Dr. Judy, of if you're feeling burned out, what can you do to make it better? Deal with it.
Make sure that you do self-care every single day in some way, as long as it's intentional and that you know it's something that you're doing just for yourself. Even something that's 5 or 10 minutes is helpful and important. So that's what I would say, is make sure to prioritize that. Self-care is essential for your mental and physical health. It's not a luxury.
Thank you, Dr. Judy. Have a great day, you and Luca. And you can have Luca go at, how old is he now?
He's 3.
3. He can go take that Strong Interest Inventory or the Kierzy Assessment. Let me know how it turns out.
Exactly. Put him to work. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank
you.
Talk
to you soon.
You bet. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.